Welcome to the World of Intelligence, a podcast for you to discover the latest analysis of global military and security trends within the open source defense intelligence community. Now onto the episode with your host, Harry Kemsley.
Hello, and welcome to this edition of World of Intelligence at Jane's by your host, Harry Kemsley, and as usual, my co-host, Sean Corbett. Hello, there. Hi. Sean, we've spoken in the past about intelligence being one of those art forms and supported by science, trying to look into the crystal ball, the future gazing, predictive analysis. So I thought today we might spend a bit of time looking at a particularly interesting area, China, Taiwan, with the question of, is China going to invade Taiwan? And if so, how could we predict that that was the case? Now, you've been in this world even longer than I have, Sean. Just how important is the China-Taiwan issue strategically?
So incredibly. I mean, it's probably what many of the strategic thinkers will be considering, and government, particularly in the US, but elsewhere as well. You know, it really is one of the most important issues of our time. And so being able to predict it is, as I think you mentioned the word there, the nirvana for the intelligence community. As my old, very distinguished boss used to say, don't read me the newspaper, don't even tell me what's going on, tell me what's going to happen. And it's a difficult thing to do.
Yeah. We've been talking in the past about the move from descriptive analytics, which I guess is the bit about reading newspaper, through to predictive analytics. And that's what we're going to try and discuss today around the Taiwan-China case study. And to do that, we've invited back a couple of guests who've spoken before on the podcast. Zavi, as one of our China experts. Hey, Zavi, how are you doing?
Harry, happy to be here.
Good. And Claire Chu. Hello, Claire.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you both back for your second or possibly third helping, I think, for one of you. Anyway, great to have you here. What I wanted to focus on to start with is, Claire, I might get you in a second, just to give us a sense of what is the current context here at the back end of 2024 into early 25. What is the current context from your understanding of the China-Taiwan dynamic? Once you've done that for us, Claire, I'm going to turn to you, Zavi, to see if you want to add anything to that, but then take us on to the piece of work that's actually going to be the centerpiece of this podcast episode, which is the work you've been doing on starting to understand what might well become a model for the indicators and warnings of the situation. All right. So, Claire, if I can start with you then, what are the current dynamics that are painting the context for us of China-Taiwan?
Absolutely. I mean, with the China and Taiwan relationship, for a very long time, the core really has been a political relationship that is affected by economic, financial, diplomatic, military, security, really a whole host of other factors. And for many years, the military dimension is one that has really led the discussion in Washington and elsewhere. And increasingly, we're seeing more and more folks start to pick up on the key importance of some of the economic and diplomatic elements as well. And so I think what Javi's report does is really dive into this axis of factors that will color the future of Taiwan's security to come. And it's also important to understand that we talk about this potential for invasion and this potential for a kinetic attack, for a contingency or even maritime blockade. But what has been happening for many years has been what could be perceived as war already. It's a war on Taiwan's international legitimacy. It's a war on Taiwan's right to self-determination. It's a war on the Taiwanese people's national will for self-defense, right? So we're already seeing some level of erosion and a really targeted attack on all of these other elements of Taiwan's security. And so the military one is really just one of many facets. And I think that's really important to emphasize whenever we're talking about the Taiwan strategic vulnerabilities.
Yeah, very good. So if I understood you correctly, Clem, please correct me if I have misdescribed this. Are you saying that the China-Taiwan relationship has been predominantly between them and economic and other factors, whilst in places like the US, it has been described more militarily? Is that what you're saying?
I think that's correct. I think that has led the discussion, and it's important for analysts to be looking at other dimensions as well.
Yeah, okay. All right, thank you. So, Zavi, your experience in the China study has been extensive. So what's your perspective on the same? And then perhaps we go straight from that into the indicators and warnings model.
I fully agree with that. I fully agree with what has just said. And I think that has been a challenge for us as analysts as well, because governments, for obvious reasons, tend to focus on the military aspect of this conflict because of the potential consequences of a military conflict, open military conflict between China and Taiwan happening, and how this would affect pretty much everyone when it comes to economics, when it comes to security concerns. However, from our point of view as China analysts or China watchers, as Claire was saying, there's many other aspects that seem to be either neglected or I would say they're not assessed to be as important. And what we tried to do from James here was bringing everything into the analysis. We didn't want to focus just on the military issue, because at the end of the day, we also understand that war or military conflict is a political activity that you conduct for political objectives. So any state, and China is no different to that, has many means at their disposal to achieve those objectives. Military means are just one group of those means.
Right. So if that is the case, I'm just curious, I'm going to tease that out a little bit further. Sean, what I think I'm hearing is that there is an overemphasis potentially in some of the analysis that have been done in the past around the military dimension, rather than what Claire and Xavier are describing, which could be more multifaceted perspectives of the relationship between China and Taiwan. Do you think that's fair?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's the classic class fiction model, isn't it? Continuation of diplomacy by other means, war. But, you know, I go back to the very, very simple equation that threat equals capability plus intent plus opportunities. So it's all very well having the intent, which you could argue, is that the case or not? And I know we'll be delving into that.
Sure.
But it's a different thing to have the intent and the capability, therefore, to do so. And then the opportunity piece comes in about, you know, external actors persuading you, again, back leading into the capability and the intent if you've got forces around there as to not to act.
Yeah. All right. Well, I probably would like to spend more time on that, but I'm going to move us on because I really want to get onto this indicators and warnings model, Xavier, that you've created. As we go through these factors that Xavier's going to describe, Claire, perhaps I can get you to step in from time to time just to sort of colour the factor that's being described. It's one of those things that I know you can do from your perspective to give it a bit more context, or even more context. So, Xavier, how have you started to think about these many different perspectives of what we could use to help us understand what might happen, the indicators and warnings?
Yeah, that's a good question. So this whole project started because we needed to answer this question, right? Is China going to invade Taiwan in the next, in our case, we're looking at an horizon of 6 to 12 months. What we needed to identify were factors or developments that would let us know or would help us guess that such an operation was being prepared.
Yes.
The assumption is any big military operation will require certain preparation, certain measures to be taken before. And some of them you can observe or you can assess. That's the approach we've taken into this. What we tried to bring into the analysis, as we were discussing before, were factors beyond the strictly military developments. Of course, we're talking about military operations, so most factors are going to be political and military. But we tried to bring in other factors, such as economic factors, too. The way we did that is we set a number of 9 to 12 indicators. We brainstormed them. We used our expertise. We used previous analysis. And then we also pulled in expertise from other teams. And we organized red team sessions. Claire was part of those red team sessions, and it was great to have her, really. And at the end of the day, our final list of indicators is a result of a work of more than 30 analysts from different backgrounds that looked into them.
So what are those indicators that you've selected from that study you did, that workshop you did?
So our main focus, of course, we're going to be political and military indicators. Yep. For the military indicators, we included the ones probably you would expect. So indicators that would point at a mobilization of troops happening, deployment of assets and troops in the areas close to the Taiwan Strait. In our case, we closed it down to the Eastern Theater Command, which is one of China's theater commands, and it's the one that deals with Taiwan just across the strait. Military infrastructure, an increase or an uptick in military drills related to Taiwan operations. Those were the military indicators. For the political indicators, we've been tracking Chinese rhetoric with the assumption that such an operation, an invasion of Taiwan, would require Chinese authorities to change the way they speak about Taiwanese citizens as well.
Let me just pause you there. Sean, I'll come back to you in just a second about the mobilization militarily, because I'm going to have to assume that that's something that various agencies of the world would be able to see and track very, very closely. Claire, just to come to you, though, on the political, the rhetoric, have you seen anything that would suggest to you there's been a shift? And by the way, what is the current rhetoric? Is it all about the economics and the relationship, or is it potentially starting to shift? Have you seen anything about the rhetoric from China that might give us a sense of the politics of this is starting to shift?
Well, when we look at rhetoric, we have to look at, or we have to determine whether certain statements are targeting a foreign audience, meaning, say, Western governments and decision makers, whether they're targeting Taiwanese citizens or Taiwanese decision makers, or if they're targeting domestic Chinese population. And I think that's important because there are certain instances we've observed censorship that indicate that China may be seeking to manage domestic expectations when it comes to potential kinetic conflict across the Taiwan Strait. We've seen that more recently. The rhetoric has been actually less inflammatory than some may have expected with President Lai Ching-te's visit to the United States. We also saw that around the time of the Taiwan elections earlier this year as well, when some of the rhetoric was actually more measured and more, I think, status quo than some expected compared to, say, Nancy Pelosi's visit, when we saw a sharp escalation of statements from the Chinese government. And I think this says, you know, Taiwan, or when it comes to Taiwan, Beijing doesn't want to instigate too much conversation over topics that it can't do anything about and that it doesn't want to push the envelope on, right? Because then there may be certain expectations or red lines that the domestic population would be looking to. And because Taiwan is so important to the Chinese government, it's really important to sort of manage what the expectations for what China can do, what China will do, and what Taiwan is to China in this present day and time.
Got it. Thank you, Claire. Sean, so just going back to the question about mobilization, given that from what Claire's said, to summarize perhaps overly simplistically, the rhetoric seems to be de-escalatory, at least currently. But even so, presumably in the event that there was a mobilization or even build up for exercises, that would be tracked to very high levels of fidelity, would it not, by Western governments' abilities to do so?
Yeah, indeed. In some ways, that's the easy bit in terms of watching them mobilize. But you asked the right question there. So what are they mobilizing for? Is it exercises? I mean, you saw this in the Ukraine example, where big exercise going on. So you'd expect to forward deploy lots of equipment. You'd expect them to be operating together, combined arms way. But what you need to then work out is, okay, you know, is this in order to do something else? Or so, and there are several indicators for that. Firstly, are what we call signature equipment. So there's quite a lot of rare equipment out there, command and control stuff, some of the more sophisticated air defense. As soon as you start seeing field hospitals moving, then you take real notice. But what the Chinese tend to do, though, in terms of particularly things like encroachments, is we're seeing a lot with air and air defense activity, is what I call normalizing the abnormal. So incursions into Taiwanese airspace, you know, used to be a little bit about, hang on, what are they doing here? They do it so frequently now, it just becomes normalized. Mm-hmm. So then do you see that as an imminent to do something, or is it just normalization? And that's the key, is working out what is just posturing, what is exercising, and what is actually serious.
Yeah, I think there's also an element of what Claire just said in terms of messaging. There was a sense in China that the Chinese were impotent in this particular debate, and that was being sensed from a domestic audience, then by posturing, as you put it, by demonstrating their military prowess by huge exercises around the Taiwanese Straits, etc., would potentially be an attempt to address that internal narrative. Again, I'd love to dig further on that, but I'm going to come back to you, Zabi. So we talked about the two major indicators, political and military, rhetoric and mobilization being the obvious indicators. What other factors did you consider in the model?
So in our case, we took into account trade and economics, because China's instant facade and Saudi's facade plays a vital role in China's economy, not only because you have economic powerhouses in the provinces that are across the Taiwan Strait, but also because that's where most of the trade, the maritime trade, goes through. So there is no scenario where you can cause disturbance around Taiwan where China's economy is not affected.
Right.
But, so one of the things that we are doing as well is monitoring the value and volume of trade that goes into those ports.
So if you're looking at maritime traffic going in and out that could be affected by an excise, just to be absolutely clear, you're saying that if you suddenly saw the Chinese restricting or stopping maritime navigation through there for its own trade, that would be an indicator that they were preparing for something potentially.
Yeah, or simply if we saw that trade going into those ports is decreasing and being shifted towards other safer ports, right, that would be an indicator as well. It doesn't mean that for an invasion to happen, this condition is necessary. But if it happens, if you have this change in trade, that surely is indicating something.
It's one of the nation, presumably, with other indicators. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I was just going to reinforce, I think the economic aspect is so important because it's both a cost and a benefit scenario. I read something the other day that said that if they did invade or even blockade Taiwan, it could take something like $10 trillion off the global GDP. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that would actually fall on China themselves. So bearing in mind that, you know, China is all about the economy, Belt and Road Initiative, all those things, and actually keeping the population, in an acceptable way economically, you've got to ask the question there. If that changed in some way, then I think that would be an indicator. So Chinese economy not doing brilliantly right now, although we'd probably wish it was as good. You know, if that keeps dropping, you could look at it two ways. Either, well, we can't afford to do anything now, or the usual thing is, right, let's lash out somewhere else so that we're not looking internally. So it's such an important dynamic, but it's not a simple one. Yeah. I'm sure Claire will have something to say on that one.
Yeah, Claire, I'm just curious about your thoughts on this maritime element of the economics. I mean, just how big an issue for China is. As you mentioned earlier, that the Chinese perspective is probably dominated by the economics, a couple of other things as well, before military. So just how big an impact would this have on China if they were to act on their economy?
Yeah, I mean, there are, I think, two schools of thought on this, right? Right now, when you're looking at China domestically, and again, China's core stability and security is really the primary interest of the CCP, and the borders, including Taiwan, are also key interests, but they are in a way secondary or supplementary to internal stability and regime security. So with that in mind, right now in China, wealth is shrinking, capital is fleeing, companies are going bankrupt, right? Unemployment is up, there is deflation. And so with this context, there are some analysts who believe that China may hold off on greater escalation because for the average citizen in China, Taiwan is really going to be a secondary, if not a very low concern. There are other analysts who are watching the situation and think that maybe saber rattling is going to be actually a response to the poor economy. I think there are some different ways to watch this, and looking at it through this lens of indicators and tracking these indicators through time, I think is good observation in concert with other indicators on the military side that where economic decline or economic robust economy may lead Chinese decision makers.
Yeah, I think it's a really important point that tracking this over time, seeing the connections between these things is such an important part of any intelligence analysis, particularly of this nature. So, Zavi, just to come back to you, we've talked about political, military, trade and economics. We've mentioned a moment ago how these things might play together. Sean, you talked about opportunity being one of the parts of threat. You know, the maritime ports start to get shifted to other ports, maybe that's providing an opportunity. The saber rattling they might need to do for internal consumption might be preventing us from seeing a sort of rhetoric rise potentially. I'm trying to combine these things as we go through. But what other factors that are we going to consider then? We talk about those three and how they may start to play together. Yeah. What other factors are we considering in the model?
So, for example, in the economic side of our indicators, one of the things we're taking into account is stockpiles of key resources.
Stockpiles?
Yeah.
Right.
The assumption is if China takes any offensive action, this will trigger specifically Western powers and US and US aligned powers to apply sanctions on China.
And we saw that with Russia, right?
Yeah.
That'd be great. Yeah.
And well, we're pretty sure that that's also something that the Communist Party of China is thinking about. So if they decide to launch any sort of operation, they will very likely attempt to sanction-proof as much as they can certain resources through increasing the stockpiles of those resources or making sure that they are, again, shifting the source of imports to guarantee that at least those sources will not be as vulnerable to sanctions as they may be now, thinking, for example, about getting energy from thinking about Russia or any of these countries that would feel safer for China.
Yeah.
Right now, for example, when we look at the grains, at grain imports, most of them come from US-aligned countries, NATO and Five Eyes countries.
Right.
So in our case, that is a low level of concern when we look at this. When it comes to issuing warning, that indicator is not pushing us to say,
yeah,
well, they are going to do something big, let's say, speaking yeah. plainly, in the next 6 to 12 months.
Yeah.
Because they still rely on countries that will almost certainly support sanctions
sure.
against China.
So the stockpiles, how easy would it be to track stockpiles? I mean, grain shipments from aligned countries, relatively straightforward, I suppose. But I mean, military stockpiles, I'll come to you in a second, Sean, in terms of, without giving away anything you shouldn't, but the ability to actually track stockpiling. I recognize it as a subordinate, lower indicator than perhaps the political rhetoric might be, but how easy is it actually to track that?
The answer is it depends, right? Some of them are relatively well-known because China shares data with international institutions that yeah. double check that, or because the Chinese government itself has an interest in making sure or publicizing that they are well-stocked when it comes to right. grains for food security. In other cases, when it comes, for example, to oil stockpiles, but there's no way for us to know for certain. That's a lower confidence
yeah.
indicator. We have to deal with those challenges as well.
Sean, do we have any sense of how clear we, the Western governments, would be on stockpiling, particularly on the military side?
Perhaps, yeah, I mean, from any perspective, if we're looking at it, then yes.
Right.
I mean, there's all sorts of things. You can use satellite imagery to do volumetric analysis if stuff's being stored outside, coal, for example, all the rest of it. Oil, slightly more difficult, as you said, because, you know, you might have loads of POL tanks, but you don't know if they're full or not. But then you can track oil tankers shipping with AIS. Yes, there is ghost shipping, all the rest of it. But generally, you know, if they're building warehouses, all that sort of stuff, you'll have a fairly good handle whether, you know, they are building up their logistics supplies or their raw material supply. So that's you know, it is an indicator, but it's by no means
a strong one.
Yeah.
All right, Debbie, I'm going to come back to you then. So we've got two sub-indicators there under the trade and economic banner. What else are we adding to the list of things we're going to look at to try and get this picture?
I think one of the indicators that maybe I like the most, at a personal level, because I think it's often overlooked, is looking at what Taiwan is doing. I think one of the issues sometimes is that we tend to frame this as sort of conflict between China and the US where Taiwan has no agency. Or the Taiwanese are sort of a side actor, even if it's them that we are talking about.
Are you saying that like we behave like they don't have a vote in this? They don't have a place to play in it?
Sometimes I think they do, of course. Yes. But I think sometimes, depending on the analysis that you read, it feels like it's just the PLA's choice and then the US Armed Forces' choice and allies
right.
to decide.
And they're just in the way of a conflict.
Yeah, so they just happen to be there.
And Claire, I'm going to come to you in just a second in terms of your perspective on the Taiwanese population and their view, if you could give us a thought about that in a minute, because I think that's one of those things that often isn't discussed. What do the Taiwanese people feel? Are they staunchly against the idea of being back with China or not? But let me come back to that in a moment. So back to you.
Yeah, so one of the indicators that we have is the actions taken by the Taiwanese government. Our assumption is there's a good chance that the Taiwanese government will know earlier and better than us if something is brewing, let's say. So we've been looking at our war preparedness campaigns. We've been looking at war guidelines that might have been issued for the civilian population in case of a war or in case of a military conflict. And again, that indicator is taken into account with the other 10 indicators that we have. So it's not that we're going to make our assessment only based on this one.
Yeah.
But this helps us get a better picture because we look at what people literally across the street are doing.
Yeah, I think the assumption that they probably know more about this than those staff in London is a very good assumption. But we've also seen this war preparedness happening, haven't we, in Scandinavia, where the Norwegians and the Swedes have issued, or reissued, probably better said, guidance to the population about actions upon the event of war. Coming back to you, Claire, if I may, if it's not an unfair question, what do you think the perspective on the streets of Taiwan are about this whole debate?
Well, broadly, Taiwanese people aren't very easily rattled, right? And I think like people anywhere else, when Taiwanese go to the polls, the key issues are largely bread and butter issues at the end of the day. We saw in the last election cycle, too, a lot of the issues had to do with, I mean, actually capital punishment was up on the list. Wages, cost of living, cost of housing were really key issues people were voting on. And China was, I guess, in a way, on a ballot as well. You know, China came up at rallies and in political speeches. You see the Kuomintang party favors diplomacy engagement as a means to prevent conflict and war with China, whereas the DPP, the Democratic Progressive Party, favors more of a whole of society resilience approach to counter potential Chinese aggression. But at the end of the day, even though both parties have very different approaches and very different demographics, they are really both working towards preventing war and conflict. But at the end of the day, though, that is one of many issues that Taiwanese generationally have been dealing with for, well, again, generations, right? It's not an everyday issue.
It doesn't sound like a new issue. And I like that word resilience. Also, I like the reflection you've made of how during recent elections, the China-Taiwan issue didn't come up as a strong vote determinant, which is in itself an indicator, I guess. Thank you, Claire. Just coming back to you then, Sean, do you want to interject?
No, I was just going to, bearing in mind the time is getting on, and maybe Zabi, you're going to come on to this, but, you know, actually identifying the facts itself is particularly the way we've done it in a using several different perspectives from different analysts who know this stuff. The key, though, is weighting the factors. And so when you bring them all together, what does it mean?
Yeah.
Because the actual factors themselves are relatively straightforward.
Are there any other factors that you'd particularly want to highlight? I know you said you like the Taiwanese one, which I hadn't thought of. So yeah, I like that one too. But are there any others before we jump to the weighting question, which Sean quite rightly raises?
I think we're fine with the ones that we've mentioned, because the others are the classic military factors we've already discussed. We've talked about war rhetoric as well. And I'm just going through this very quickly. I think we've got the main one.
All right. Okay, well, that then said, then let's move on to how you weight them. Because you said several times during that here are a couple of powerful indicators and here are less powerful indicators. How do you weight them?
So that is a very good question. And I think that is a challenging process. What we did is we gathered a group of analysts and we used structured analytical technique, so SATs, to allow us to find a method to weigh the indicators. The way we did it is we compared each of the analysts present there, weighed each indicator against all the others. And we had to pick one each time and then decide a factor for that difference. So if, let's say I was comparing indicator A with indicator B, I had to decide which one was the heavier, the stronger of the two.
Okay.
And then by a factor of one.
Okay.
A degree of three, we get one, two, or three.
So you go through a series of analyses like that, you start to understand how expert analysts view the relative weighting, and you do that over enough turns of the handle to the point that you've got a sort of a mean position of relative weighting.
Yeah. And what we found at the end of this process is that for 7 of those 11 indicators, we had the same ranking across all of the analysts. So we were happy with that. So, for example, we all agreed that mobilization of troops was a strong indicator.
Sure.
Some others, though, we had a bit of a difference. So that's where qualitative discussion entered the game.
A healthy debate was had.
Yes. Yes. Everyone survived. And yeah, then we just red teamed those internally.
Right. And I think, Claire, you were involved in the red teaming. Were you involved in this weighting debate as well?
No, not so much. But I think it sounds like a great methodology to, as you mentioned before, not just keep tabs on those indicators, but really keep tabs on them and their importance over time.
Yeah, and presumably, Xavier, as we go through, we'll start to look at those weightings as events start to occur. We're looking for them to start modeling the world in the future. So if it's not modeling it correctly, I don't mean a foreign invasion, I mean potentially for other things, that we'll then change those weightings accordingly, presumably.
Yeah, absolutely. So the last step of the process, once we had the indicators, when we had our assessment for each of the indicators, once we had the weighting, was deciding what was going to happen next.
Right.
And what we did is we drafted 5 potential scenarios, from an all-out invasion to China discontinuing, let's say, or abandoning the goal. I don't think it's a spoiler for anyone that to say that this last scenario of China abandoning the goal of unification was
a high probability. No,
didn't get much.
Yeah.
But then we pitched each of our assessments for the indicators against each of the scenarios. So I'm going to try to explain that a bit better. Imagine a chart, a matrix, where you have each row is a different assessment for the indicators,
yeah.
Each column is a different scenario.
Right.
And what we did is, okay, this scenario assessment, would that fit this scenario? Yes or no? Would that fit the next scenario? Yes or no?
Right.
We did that for the 11 indicators.
So you've profiled the indicators by scenario in a way that allows you to effectively model the types of indicators and the threshold they need to reach for that scenario to become more likely.
And then what you end up having for those 5 scenarios that we have is, okay, so we have, let's say, 3 out of the 11 indicators now would fit this scenario. 5 of the 11 indicators would fit this other scenario.
Right.
11 of the 11 indicators would fit scenario 4. And 0 or 1 of those indicators would fit scenario 5.
Right.
Then, of course, you assess that against the weight of each indicators, because having 5 weak indicators probably points towards a lower likelihood than having 3 strong indicators.
Got it. Okay, so Sean, I'm curious, from your background in the intelligence world, which is extensive, have you ever come across an analysis quite as rigorous as that?
So I've spent an awful lot of time looking at indicators and warnings in my previous existence, and you know, it'd be fair to say we never got it fully right, because this is it's back to the art versus science. I would say that our model probably wasn't as sophisticated, so we'd come up with however many questions, generally about a dozen, so not far off the same. And then a slightly different approach in terms of, if 7 of those 12 happens, something's going to happen. If only 4 happens. So I didn't think we actually got, this is some time ago now, so they might be doing it now. We got to that next level of analysis that Xavi's talked about in terms of, okay, weight them. And then if these 3 but those 4 don't happen, or 1, 2, and 7 happens, what does this mean? Which is quite sophisticated. But I go back to, it's a great tool, and I commend the work that's been done on this, because you've got to, it's back to showing out your working out, you know, because you know, if we end up getting an assessment saying in the next 6 months, China's going to invade Taiwan, you've got to be able to really back it up. Yeah. And I'm not saying that's going to happen, by the way, because but so the sophistication, the next level analysis is great. But just one final thing is that what's really difficult to factor in to these models is effectively the will. What is the cost of success, for example, because maybe for another time, but it is not particularly straightforward for China to invade Taiwan because of all sorts of factors, you know, environmental, geographical, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, what are they prepared to lose? And that's as much at the strategic level. So to lose any standing on the world stage, the economy, as we've already discussed, will go down. But it's a gain loss, back to the gain loss thing. You know, would that, and I'm sure they're looking at the West and, you know, our lack of strategic patience in terms of they'll get bored soon. So if we take out Taiwan, then actually there'll be lots of harumphing, but within 5 years, 10 years, if they can stomach that, then maybe it's back to normal again.
Yeah, interesting. All right, well, look, given that time is now starting to evaporate on us, and there are about 10 topics I'd like to spend another hour on, we don't have time for that. Let me just start to pull this conversation around to a takeaway. And as I ask each of you to give the audience your one takeaway you'd like them to remember from this, I'm going to ask you, Xavi, Claire, Sean,
to also tell me whether you think there's likely to be an invasion of Taiwan by China in the next 12 months. Okay. So let me start with you in terms of your one takeaway. What's the one thing from all your work you'd like the audience to take away from this?
Well, the main takeaway of the report is it's very unlikely that China will invade.
Very
unlikely.
Unlikely. I didn't hear the "un." I'm going to just...
Yeah, it's very unlikely that China will invade Taiwan in the next 6 to 12 months. So that's the headline of our report. That's the takeaway that I'd like to finish with.
Very good. And you answered the question as well. Well done. Claire?
I think in addition to understanding what may or may not happen is to understand what the options are for the U.S. and allied partners that have some level of commitment to Taiwan's freedom and democracy. And by that, I mean, there are certain red lines for if there were, again, a kinetic invasion, right? But what about if the, you know, the conflict is psychological and it's economic and it's financial? What do we do then? We've seen some level of incursion by Chinese, say, merchant fleets. Is there a red line that the U.S. has drawn in that situation? And there's not. So I think in addition to understanding these indicators and tracking and being able to have this forecasting ability, it's also important to step up the, again, the options that are available and to increasingly reconsider what red lines may look like in a scenario that is so multifaceted and primarily existing in the gray zone as we see it today.
Yeah, I think it's a really good takeaway. Thank you, Claire. Sean?
Yeah, slightly stole mine there, actually, about the gray zone hybrid warfare, because it's absolutely a great point. You know, it's not an absolute, do they invade, don't they? There's so many grays on that. And back to, again, what was said is that, you know, we have a vote on this. I don't know how much of a vote. When I say we, I mean the West, you know, the US in particular. So back to being the cost. But I think the ultimate takeaway, though, is that predictive analysis has to be where the intelligence analyst has to or tries to get to.
Yeah.
And as you've heard me say a million times, it doesn't matter if you're wrong, as long as you're not catastrophically wrong, providing you have given the assumptions, you've given the alternative analysis, and you've given the working out onto why you've come to where you have, because that gives your decision makers and the policy makers enough to go with, okay, on the balance of probability, which is really what we're talking about here, this is most likely, but we can still factor in all the eventualities and actually influence those factors as well. So it reduces the number of factors that are more likely, as likely to make things happen. So this is not easy, and it's particularly complex. And my answer also is no, they're not going to do it.
I didn't actually answer you, Claire. I'm assuming yours was also a no, Claire.
No to a kinetic invasion. Yes to increased coercion and corrosive practices.
That's a good caveat.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I think my takeaway from this conversation is actually it's one takeaway, but it's actually in two parts. One, I think, as Sean just said, the indicators and warnings is a necessary and important part of intelligence process about helping to reduce the uncertainty. But secondly, linked to that, the uncertainty doesn't have to be just around the military invasion in this environment. The world of dime that we talked about for many decades, diplomatic, etc., I don't think it's as simple as the military environment. And I think the point you made right at the beginning, Claire, about the focus of the conversation, the discourse between China and Taiwan is extensively around economics, trade, and so on, cultural. And in the US and in the West, the focus seems to be on the military. And that may well be a misjudgment that we need to be very, very careful about for the exact reasons you've raised. So it's multifaceted. Maybe we're only focusing on one facet because it's easy to do that. A trigger of a kinetic effect is easy to spot. A trigger that is gray warfare, economic or diplomatic or something to do with democracy, much more difficult to detect and to do something about. Well, with that, all I can say is, as usual, Zavi, thank you. Claire, thank you again for joining us for a second or third helping. For the audience, I hope you found that as interesting as I did. If you have any questions at all, then please do use the email that you'll see in the link for this podcast to send your questions, and I'll make sure that we'll get some answers back to you if we can. And for now, all I can say is, sure, I didn't say thank you to you as well. Thank you, as always, for your contribution.
Okay.
And thank you to the audience for listening. Thank you again. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us this week on The World of Intelligence. Make sure to visit our website, janes.com/podcast, where you can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Google Podcasts, so you'll never miss an episode.